Today is Tuesday, December 15th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, Americans start to receive COVID-19 vaccines.
This weekend's shipment of vaccines is 2.9 million doses, enough to vaccinate 2.9 million people.
Also ahead, India's protesting farmers are not giving up their struggle.
So now there's literally a sea of farmers for nearly 2 kilometers at some of the biggest protest sites that have sprung up along these highways that lead into Delhi.
Plus, a look at the state of U.S. democracy after a tumultuous election. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the U.S., where doses of the first federally approved coronavirus vaccine were administered to frontline healthcare workers Monday. That signals what health officials call a significant turn in the fight against the virus that has claimed more than 300,000 lives in the U.S. alone. VOA's Jesusimen Oni has more.
A turning point in the battle against COVID-19 as the first round of vaccinations in the United States begin. After witnessing the suffering and deaths of COVID-19 patients, ICU nurse Sandra Lindsay didn't hesitate to be the first in line.
I hope this marks the beginning to the end of a very painful time in our history.
The vaccines come at a critical time as the U.S. passes 300,000 COVID-19-related deaths. The pandemic continues to overwhelm hospitals and devastate the nation's economy. But with the first shipments of the recently approved Pfizer vaccine arriving at 636 sites across the U.S. and a second vaccine slated for FDA approval later this week, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar says hope is on the way.
As we speak, vaccine is arriving at sites and in trucks and planes owned by UPS and FedEx to bring these life-saving products to the places where Americans will receive them. This weekend's shipment of vaccines is 2.9 million doses, enough to vaccinate 2.9 million people.
Starting off the mass immunization campaign are those considered at highest risk, such as healthcare workers and nursing home residents. Vaccinations for the general public are not expected to be available until late spring 2021, enough time, experts hope, to persuade the skeptics.
The existence of the vaccine alone does not end a pandemic. What you need is you need a population willing to accept the vaccine.
The pandemic's devastating reach goes well beyond the U.S. population, hence a need for a multilateral approach to ending it, says infectious disease expert Dr. Bill Petrie.
We're not going to control this unless we have all the countries in the world vaccinated. Otherwise, we're just going to have like continued outbreaks, continued problems.
Several countries, including the United Kingdom and Canada, also have authorized the Pfizer vaccine. And the World Health Organization reports there are more than 50 COVID-19 vaccines in human trials around the globe. Each vaccine, experts say, would be welcomed in the race to end this pandemic one needle at a time. Jesus Amaoni, VOA News, Washington.
Other countries which have begun vaccinating their citizens against COVID-19 include the United Kingdom, Russia, and China. The disease has infected more than 71 million people worldwide and is responsible for more than 1.6 million deaths in the past year. On Monday, the U.S. Electoral College affirmed President-elect Joe Biden's presidential win over sitting President Donald Trump. Following the confirmation of his victory, Biden gave a speech from his home in Wilmington, Delaware. In the speech, he criticized President Donald Trump for threatening core principles of democracy. Biden was blunt in critiquing the damage done by Trump's baseless allegations that the contest was stolen.
The Trump campaign brought dozens and dozens and dozens of legal challenges to test the result. They were heard again and again. And each of the times they were heard, they were found to be without merit. Time and again, President Trump's lawyers presented arguments to state officials, state legislatures, state and federal courts, and ultimately to the United States Supreme Court twice. They're heard by more than 80 judges across this country, and in every case, no cause or evidence was found to reverse or question or dispute the results. His own cybersecurity chief overseeing this election said it was the most secure in American history.
Alongside his critique of Trump, Biden tried to hit an optimistic note.
You know, in this battle, for the soul of America, democracy prevailed. We, the people, voted. Faith in our institutions held. The integrity of our elections remains intact. And now it's time to turn the page, as we've done throughout our history, to unite, to heal. As I said in this campaign, I will be president for all Americans. I'll work just as hard for those of you who didn't vote for me as I will for those who did. There's urgent work in front of us.
Biden and his team hope that the formal victory in the Electoral College will help the country unify and accept his presidency. But the challenge facing Biden was evident as many congressional Republicans, including some of the party's top leaders, refused to officially accept Biden's win. Trump, meanwhile, shows no sign of conceding. While Biden asserted that democracy prevailed in America, just how strong is America's democracy after years of bitterly divisive politics? To find out, I reached out to Sarah Rapucci, who is Vice President of Research and Analysis at the Washington, D.C.-based organization Freedom House. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. So let's start off by looking at Biden's speech last night. He struck this positive tone that democracy has been tested, but it prevailed. What do you make of that?
So I agree with that. I mean, I think that, you know, we've just come through a very contentious election period, and it's easy in that situation to lose sight of democracy's successes. But really, here in the United States, our democracy is very resilient. It definitely has gone through a lot, but I am hopeful now that we can move forward.
When you say U.S. democracy has gone through a lot, what are the tests of U.S. democracy that have taken place in this election cycle?
Well, you know, an election is the fundamental core of any democracy. And when it's especially polarized, especially combative, it can lead the public to wonder, to doubt in the democracy. The American public has been deeply divided, both over this election, but also just over the Trump presidency as a whole and how they feel about it. And those divisions run so deep that people don't always trust the other side. They don't always know what to believe. And I think that the fact that President Trump claimed that there was fraud in this election, when in fact this has been one of the most secure elections in U.S. history, and there's been no evidence of widespread fraud, I think that that has really caused a crisis of doubt in our democracy that unfortunately was really unnecessary given the lack of evidence.
That's such a powerful phrase. You said this crisis of doubt. You know, we're in a situation where a large portion of the electorate just doesn't accept the results of the election. So what can be done to repair that?
I think that the two places we really need to look to are the administration and Congress. So, you know, in terms of the administration, I think that Biden needs to be really careful. I mean, he has a mandate, but it's not a huge mandate. And he needs to be careful that he is governing for the American public as a whole and for everybody's interests, not just the people who voted for him. There are people who had real concerns and did not vote for him. And he needs to understand those concerns, and he needs to lead in a way that addresses everybody's interests, not just the interests of the people that voted for him. On Congress's side, I think it's more important than ever that we find the places of agreement between Democrats and Republicans. And I think this is especially possible around the fundamentals of our democracy and how important it is.
And on that point, how possible do you think that is? Because despite this election being finalized, there were some 100 Republican lawmakers who supported the case trying to overturn the results of the election. When you have that many lawmakers, nearly a quarter of the House of Representatives, that doesn't seem like a simple thing to overcome.
No, it's true. It's going to be very challenging. It's not going to be easy. I think it speaks to the fact that, you know, I think many people in this country and around the world sort of took the United States' democracy for granted. And democracy it's not an endpoint. It's something that needs to be fostered and worked on, and it will be very challenging. And it's going to require real leadership on the part of the Biden administration. It's going to require leadership on the part of members of Congress who can show that they are above the political fray and they're willing to stand up for our common values and principles instead of for their party. You know, hopefully when, you know, kind of the dust settles and President Biden is the president, we won't have to continue to litigate this. But yes, it will be challenging.
That's Sarah Ripucci, Vice President of Research and Analysis at the Washington, D.C.-based organization Freedom House. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jason. Take care.
Earlier this year, police in many American cities were heavily criticized for their violent response to the largely peaceful protests against police brutality and racism that erupted across the country following the death of George Floyd in police custody in May. This past weekend's violent protests in Washington, D.C. have again cast a spotlight on the role of police during protests. Four people were stabbed and dozens arrested as members of a far-right group known as the Proud Boys faced off in the nation's capital against left-wing anti-fascist counter-protesters. Amid the clashes, members of both sides have accused officers of not doing their jobs properly to prevent violence. To make sense of this complicated situation, I reached out to Marissa Lang. She is a reporter at the Washington Post who has been covering protests and policing in the U.S. Capitol. Hi, Marissa. How are you today?
Good.
So, Marissa, since late May, there have been many protests in which left-wing racial justice protesters have faced off against police. But now that's changing as we have far-right groups coming into Washington, D.C. Can you set the stage here of these last two far-right marches that have taken place in November and now this past one over the weekend?
In November, during the first MAGA march, there were thousands of Trump supporters and Proud Boys and militia members and members of other sort of far right conspiracy groups or agitators who came to D.C. And they outnumbered the counter protesters who showed up by a huge margin. I would estimate there were only a couple hundred counter protesters. And the police during that incident tried to keep the groups separated and put themselves in a lot of ways in the middle physically to try to separate the groups. But of course, as night fell, as groups kind of moved around the city or smaller groups broke off, that became a lot harder. So this time, I think they found themselves in a similar position of trying to figure out how do we keep these groups separated? How do we keep confrontations to a minimum? But of course, it was only partially successful.
And let's get into that. The police are finding themselves in the middle of these groups. And of course, one group has been very vocal against the police. And the other group, at least in part, has expressed support for police. So how have police managed that, being in between these groups, which have very different views of the police themselves?
I think it depends on who you ask. Certainly, they were able to, I think, prevent some worse confrontations from happening. That's not to say there weren't any. There were quite a few pretty violent confrontations that did happen. But the police shut down the area right around Black Lives Matter Plaza, which has for months been kind of the epicenter of these protests, the racial justice protests we've seen in D.C. And by doing that, they eliminated the possibility that folks who wanted to come and tear down signs or cause some more violence would get to the plaza. So in that way, I think they were successful in maintaining some separation. But what they did do and what they have been criticized for was the level of force used against the two groups was not equal. And the way in which they approached the two groups, even verbally, was not equal. You know, they will yell at one, and then the other one, they'll say, please move back, thank you for cooperating. And people notice the difference. And as you pointed out, obviously, one group is much more cooperative with them than the other. The right-wing protesters are out there chanting Blue Lives Matter, and they're much more deferential to police officers than some of the left-wing protesters who are not and who, you know, are out there yelling expletives at the police. So it is definitely a different vibe coming from both groups.
You mentioned earlier the march in November, and you and your colleagues wrote a really interesting article going in depth into how the police approached the different groups in that time. Did you notice a change from November to this latest march over the weekend in how police approached these large and what ended up being violent marches?
I did. So the the article you referenced, we pointed out a number of incidents that some of our local DC activists have noted appeared to them as if the police were choosing sides. And it appeared to them as if the police were aligning themselves with the pro-Trump demonstrators. They were doing things like posing for pictures and giving thumbs up signs, or the way that they were positioning themselves and their shields and their body language just seemed to indicate that they were more protective over that group and more antagonistic toward the group of counter-protesters. I will say that this time around, after that article ran, I did notice a difference. I think it was probably the most confrontational I have seen the police get with the far-right demonstrators. They did deploy some similar tactics that they typically use on some of the racial justice protesters against the Proud Boys and some of the other agitators on the right. They used, you know, bicycles as sort of barricades and shields to push them back. They were much more aggressive about not letting them through the police line in certain instances, especially around Black Lives Matter Plaza. So I think overall, I did notice that they seemed a little bit more, I don't want to say aggressive, but they did seem a little bit more hard line with them than I have seen in the past. And certainly I did not observe anybody posing for photos or doing some of that. But I also think that that is because when I was out there, it was at nighttime and it was just a different kind of day. But yeah, I did notice some differences.
That's Marissa Lang, reporter at The Washington Post here in Washington, D.C. Marissa, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
This is VOA. Robert R. Riley has returned as the new director of The Voice of America nearly 20 years after he last held the post. In an email to staff, he said Monday, quote, "It is a great privilege for me to return as director of The Voice of America," end quote. However, Riley's appointment has been controversial, in part due to his past statements and publications disparaging LGBTQ and Muslim people. Yesterday, a group of anonymous whistleblowers filed a complaint to VOA's parent agency's CEO, Michael Pack, demanding he rescind Riley's appointment. They said, quote, "Mr. Riley has a troubling history of mismanagement at VOA, and he is openly hostile to Muslims and gays. His controversial personal beliefs, which have been widely published, jeopardize the credibility and reputation of VOA, its journalists, editors, and producers," end quote. Separately, the previous VOA director, Amanda Bennett, in an op-ed published by The Washington Post last week, citing Riley's published views on gays and Muslims, said, quote, "Riley is a dangerous choice. His views are not conservative. They are extreme," end quote. In his Monday email to staff, Riley appeared to defend himself from such criticism. He wrote, quote, "Over the years, I have written hundreds of articles and a number of books and monographs on a wide array of subjects. They are irrelevant to my duties as VOA director, with the possible exception of those about VOA and the broader subject of public diplomacy." He continued, "A VOA director, like any journalist, should leave his or her personal opinions at the door," end quote. Hungary's parliament, where the ruling nationalist party of Prime Minister Viktor Orban has a two-thirds majority, passed a law today which practically bans adoptions by same-sex couples. The legislation proposed by Orban's government says only married couples can adopt children and single people can only adopt with special permission from the Family Affairs Minister. Hungary does not allow gay marriage. Rights group Amnesty International criticized the law, calling it, quote, "discriminatory, homophobic, and transphobic," end quote. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Leaders of thousands of Indian farmers demanding the repeal of three new laws on agricultural reform have threatened to block trains in an escalation of their three-week protest. The farmers say they fear officials will use the laws to force down minimum guaranteed grain prices, a charge the government denied. For more, VOA's Chinadu O4 spoke with journalist Anjana Pasrika in New Delhi.
So now there's literally a sea of farmers for nearly 2 kilometers at some of the biggest protest sites that have sprung up along these highways that lead into Delhi. These highways have been their home for 3 weeks now. They came in tractors and trailers. These are parked all along the side. In the day, you see these farmers, you know, listening to their leaders. They've strung up banners with slogans like "No farmers, no food. We are farmers, not terrorists." Through the day, you see many of them helping out in makeshift kitchens, chopping onions, cauliflowers, making stacks of bread called rotis in open-air kitchens. They sleep inside the trailers or even on the road. They came equipped with mattresses and blankets. If you ask them, how are they managing in the cold Delhi winter? Well, they just say, we are farmers, we are hardy, we are used to braving the elements, and we are going to stay here until our demands are met.
These protests have been going on for weeks now. Any indications as to when they might end?
I don't see an end to the standoff on the immediate horizon because of the farmers' insistence that the laws must be scrapped. They worry that the free market will lower crop prices and make agriculture unviable for them, particularly for rice and wheat, which are grown in the northern states. You know, most of these farmers are coming from these states of Punjab and Haryana. The government has offered concessions on some of their key demands, such as ensuring minimum prices for crops and continuing with the state program of buying the food grains, which is what the farmers want. But it has also made it clear that while they can amend some rules, there is no question of rolling back the laws. Prime Minister Narendra Modi today blamed the opposition for spreading fears and said the government is committed to farmer welfare. But where a midway point will be found, it's hard to say.
With the government standing by its position and the farmers standing by their own position, what do you think might happen?
It's hard to say, actually, because the farmers, for the time being, are threatening to intensify the stir. And they say they are prepared for a long, drawn-out battle. I mean, they've said 6 months, we'll stay here, no problem. So far, they are imbued with the do-or-die spirit. Their numbers are swelling daily, and I think they believe they can win because any government in India cannot be seen as being too tough on farmers because they form a key voting bloc. Although this particular protest is restricted mostly to farmers from northern India, farmers all over India make up about 60% of the population, or rather not just farmers, but farming families make up 60% of the population. But, you know, the insistence on a complete rollback is making a solution appear tough. Who blinks first, again, as I said, is hard to say.
That's Anjana Pasrika in New Delhi speaking to my colleague Chinadu Ofor. A bomb attack in Afghanistan's capital city killed the deputy governor of Kabul today, security officials said, adding that a bomb was attached to his car by unknown assailants. Emmer McCarthy of Reuters reports.
Kabul's deputy governor, Mahbubullah Mahebi, was killed in a bomb attack in the city on Tuesday, according to security officials. A sticky bomb was attached to his car by unknown assailants. Mahebi was travelling with his security guards when the blast occurred. Two guards were also injured in the blast. This eyewitness says he was opening his shop when the explosion occurred and then dust rose from the blast area. No militant group has made an immediate claim of responsibility for the blast. It comes after an Afghan government prosecutor was shot dead in eastern Kabul while he was on his way to work last week.
That's Emmer McCarthy of Reuters, and that's it for our show today. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, my colleague, Chinadu Ofor, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Issues in the News moderator Dan Raviv and a panel of experts as they analyze the top stories of the week, including the biggest vaccination campaign in American history, beginning with healthcare workers getting COVID-19 shots around the nation. Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.